This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Thursday, January 31st, 2008. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns. In today's program, Minnesota tribal members express concern about new border crossing ID requirements. A wheat shortage in Pakistan threatens the country's food supply. And the Israeli Supreme Court rules the country's imposed fuel shortages are not creating a human rights crisis in Gaza. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. New data shows that suicides among U.S. Army personnel are at their highest level since the Army began keeping records in the 1980s. Suicides jumped by as much as 20% in the past year. As many as 121 military personnel took their lives in 2007, although more than 30 of those deaths are under investigation to confirm if they were in fact suicides. Attempted suicides and self-inflicted injuries have also risen to around 2,100 cases last year. That's more than five times the number reported in 2002. The psychological and sometimes traumatic stress of the job is considered a major factor in the suicide rate. Attempts to shorten the tour of duty from 15 months to 12 months have so far been unsuccessful. In India, widows and children of the victims of farm suicides in the northern state of Punjab marched in New Delhi today to demand a waiver for their farm debts. Bismillah Gilani reports.
Hundreds of school children and activists joined today's silent protest march by the widows and children of Punjabi farmers who have committed suicide due to indebtedness. Wearing T-shirts with the message, "Every farmer counts, every child dreams," the marchers demanded the government waive crushing farm debts that have been blamed for thousands of farmer suicides. The protesting children said they have had to give up their studies in order to work to pay back local money lenders without any help from the local administration. The high suicide rate among the farmers has been a burning issue in India for several years now. More than 17,000 farmers are believed to have ended their lives in the country in the past year alone. Experts say economic factors like crop failure, unemployment, and indebtedness have been pushing the victims to end their lives. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
South African police raided a Methodist church in Johannesburg last night, arresting around 1,500 indigent people, many of them refugees from neighboring Zimbabwe. Mpumi Magwaza reports from Durban, South Africa.
The Central Methodist Church in Johannesburg is well known as a refuge for Zimbabweans, migrants, and South African homeless. An estimated 1,200 people were inside of the church and hundreds more outside of it when South African police carried out their raid last night. Bishop Paul Fearing, who runs the church, says the police used inappropriate force against people and church property during the course of the raid. Some of those arrested who could prove their papers are in order have since returned to the church. Those who are still waiting for the response to their petition for asylum may face deportation. Reporting for FSRN, this is Mbomi Magwaza in Durban.
The advocacy group Human Rights Watch released its annual report today. Heather Risby has more from the United Nations.
The report says authoritarian governments backed by the U.S. can easily get away with calling themselves democratic by holding sham elections. Among others, it named former General Pervez Musharraf, who continues to rule Pakistan, as a controversial civilian president. Washington's support for Musharraf has not wavered, despite the fact that he has arrested hundreds of democracy activists and fired the country's Supreme Court. According to the 569-page Human Rights Watch report, Washington and its allies are backing undemocratic rulers in order to pursue economic and political interests. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
The Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in the San Francisco Bay Area has begun operating a high-containment biolab to experiment on deadly airborne pathogens. Kelly Ramirez has the story.
The new lab is biosafety level 3, meaning it can handle pathogens such as live anthrax, plague, and so-called select agents, which are historically associated with biowarfare. The lab is also eligible to conduct research on HIV, tuberculosis, and antibiotic-resistant bacteria. This is the first level 3 lab to be run by the Department of Energy. DOE is taking several precautions above and beyond what is generally required for a Level 3 lab, including psychological examinations of lab personnel. But that's not enough for Tri-Valley Cares, a local Livermore Lab watchdog group. Executive Director Mary Leah Kelly.
They're doing these deadly experiments in a prefabricated building that they literally brought in on a truck. And the nearest earthquake fault zone is less than 200 feet from the lab boundary.
Tri-Valley Cares is preparing to sue DOE to stop biolab operations. For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramaris.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
A Minnesota tribe is raising concerns about new border crossing rules. Starting January 31st, all people traveling into the United States will be expected to carry a passport or an accepted form of photo identification and proof of citizenship, like a driver's license and birth certificate. The change is part of the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative that is set to go into full effect in June of 2009. WTIP's Barbara Jean Myers has more.
The Grand Portage Band of Lake Superior Chippewas Reservation makes up the northernmost tip of Cook County. Chairman Norman Deschamps says border crossing rules are a major concern of the tribe.
You know, this is where we've lived, and you know, we've moved freely back, and by freely I mean with, you know, we're not required to have any of these kind of things, and it's going to change that. But that's why it's important, I think, is the government and their efforts to try to do something about security is kind of really infringing on a way of life that's been here forever.
The free movement of Native people across the northern border is protected by the Jay Treaty. The Jay Treaty goes back to 1794, and the rite of passage was restated in the 1952 Immigration and Naturalization Act.
Right now, the Jay Treaty, which is in existence, allows band members to come down from, or Indians from Canada, to work for us, as long as they're 51% Native ancestry.
Deschamps says the tribe is concerned about the impact it will have on its employees from Canada.
A lot of the people that work for us are from reserves that are fly-in reserves. There is no access, and a lot of them weren't born in hospitals. So there sometimes is no birth record or birth certificate for them. And we found out since that there is a process to get one, but it's another process again.
The tribe is also concerned the rules will impact tourism. Deschamps says it hasn't been easy to work with Homeland Security. Tribes across the country have been calling for a tribal ID card that would meet the government security requirements. Deschamps says, as of yet, that hasn't come to fruition. But Mike Milne, a spokesman for the Office of Border Protection, says the Department of Homeland Security has been working closely with tribal nations to come up with an acceptable, secure form of documentation. When pressed for more specific information regarding which groups the agency has been working with, he responded,
"I don't know, because I don't, you know, I'm not in the Department of Homeland Security. I'm in Customs and Border Protection. So all that's being done in Washington, D.C. at the department level. What they do at the department level is they work out the details, and then they basically give us what the policy will be that we will enforce at the border ports."
But Laura Keener, press secretary for the Department of Homeland Security in Washington, D.C., didn't have any specific information regarding which tribes the agency is working with.
I am under the impression our Customs and Border Protection office is really the point on this. That's one of our the agencies that works within the Department of Homeland Security. I am in the Secretary's office, so I don't have the full list in front of me, but I know that we have been actively engaged with tribal leadership on this.
Deschamps says there's no real progress being made today on tribal IDs, and that the Grand Portage Band has yet to have a single official visit from anyone in the Department of Homeland Security or the Office of Border Protection. The tribe has hired someone in Canada to work with Native people on getting the documents they will now need in order to cross the border. The U.S. State Department has launched a new passport card that will allow U.S. travelers to return from Canada or Mexico by land. The card will cost about $45, and citizens can begin the application process February 1st. Reporting for FSRN, I'm Barbara Jean Myers in Cook County, Minnesota.
A federal judge ruled yesterday on a long-standing lawsuit filed by Indian landowners against the Interior Department. The lawsuit alleged the department mismanaged Indian trust funds to the tune of $100 billion. The judge ruled the Interior Department unreasonably delayed its accounting for the money. The judge partly blamed Congress for not appropriating sufficient funds to figure out where the missing money went. A hearing will be scheduled in the next month to discuss ways to solve the accounting shortcomings. In related news, 4 days after President Bush gave his State of the Union address, the National Congress of American Indians gave its 6th annual State of the Indian Nations address in Washington, D.C. FSRN's Karen Miller was there and files this report.
President of the National Congress of American Indians, Joe Garcia, said today's State of the Indian Nations address was devoted not only to the current generation of American Indians, but also the generation to come.
Poverty, lack of jobs and preventive health care, inadequate juvenile rehabilitation, shortfalls in education, all these problems push too many young people into failure.
In the address, Garcia focused on financial literacy among young and elderly American Indians and says that current plans leave many American Indians with the short end of the stick.
The President and Congress are now debating an economic stimulus package to help prevent recession. But with unemployment at an average of 49%, Indian country is in a perpetual recession. The rest of the nation will get a multi-billion dollar stimulus package that does not help our communities. Most of the current proposals are focusing on personal income tax rebates. But when unemployment rates as high as 80% exist in many of our communities, these packages leave us behind.
Healthcare was another top priority. Garcia stressed the importance of passing the Indian Health Care Improvement Act, which he says will, quote, bring Indian health care into the 21st century. The bill will modernize the Indian health care system for the first time in 16 years. Heather Don Thompson, Director of Governmental Affairs for the National Congress of American Indians, says there has been a valiant effort to get passage.
We have elders that save up all their money to fly to D.C., to meet with members of Congress to try and express how important this is to them. We have tribal leaders that have been flying back and forth every month to try and express how important this is to them.
In the address, Garcia also mentioned several current successes, such as the passing of the Indian Child and Family Violence Prevention Act and securing money from Congress to combat the fast-growing meth problem in Indian country. Garcia also noted the successful passage of the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People and said steps have been made to have Native Cold Talkers from World War I and World War II congressionally recognized. Robert Moore is a council representative from the Rosebud Sioux Tribe in Rosebud, South Dakota. He was at the address today and says even though there have been successes, the relationship between the federal government and American Indians is a sticky one, and tribes receive quite a bit of lip service.
Those are the top senior level officials at cabinet level positions that, for the most part, bring us great news, bring us hope in building a relationship, and then take it back when it gets to a staff level where the work and the rubber meets the road. Sometimes it's not there, that same commitment's not there that we heard about from the cabinet level position.
In addition to the State of the American Indian Address, the National Congress has also kicked off an election initiative called 2008 Native Vote Campaign in an effort to increase American Indian participation in the election process. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
Presidential candidates are busy jockeying for votes in the lead-up to Super Tuesday. California has been a major focus for candidates because of the high number of delegates up for grabs. Because most of the delegates are awarded on a district-by-district basis there, localized voter blocks have become all the more important. Today, Republican John McCain picked up the endorsement of Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Senator McCain has proven over and over again that he is reaching across the aisle in order to get things done.
The four remaining Republican candidates battled it out at a California debate last night, all trying to position themselves as the most similar to Ronald Reagan. The event was held at Reagan's Presidential Library, with his Air Force One serving as the backdrop for the presidential hopefuls. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more.
After a big win in Florida on Tuesday, John McCain seemed on top of his throne at the CNN Politico debate. He and Mitt Romney dominated most of the discussion, where Romney was forced to explain his government-mandated universal health care plan he implemented as governor of Massachusetts, while McCain tried to convince the conservative crowd that he was strong on the economy. Mike Huckabee, meanwhile, struggled to gain much speaking time. He differed from Romney and McCain on the proposed economic stimulus package that would give most taxpayers $600 refunds.
If we end up with the rebates, we're going to borrow the $150 billion from China. And when we turn it into rebates, most people are going to go out and buy some consumables, like a pair of shoes that they probably don't even need, but they're going to buy them, and they're most likely an import from China. My point is, whose economy are we stimulating when we do that?
Huckabee, Romney, and McCain all addressed immigration, all continuing to move further to the right. First, Huckabee says the border wall can be built with haste.
It's first making sure that that fence is built, I think, within 18 months. And the second thing is that we have a process where the people who are here would have to go to the back of the line and start over.
Romney now says many undocumented people can be deported within 90 days.
You say to those that have just come in recently, we're going to send you back home immediately. We're not going to let you stay here. You just go back home. For those that have been here, let's say 5 years and have kids in school, you allow kids to complete the school year. You allow people to make their arrangements and allow them to return back home. Those that have been here a long time with kids that have responsibilities here and so forth, you let stay enough time to organize their affairs and go home.
And Senator McCain says he would not vote for the comprehensive immigration legislation that he wrote with Senator Ted Kennedy. He has recently adopted a secure border first approach.
We know what the situation is today. The people want the border secured first.
Ron Paul provided a vastly different approach to domestic and foreign policy, with as little federal government intervention as possible. All candidates suggested that they uphold Ronald Reagan's conservative beliefs. Two remaining Democrats, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, will have their turn in Hollywood tonight. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Israeli Supreme Court reaffirmed yesterday its November 2007 ruling that Israeli cuts of Gaza's power and fuel supplies does not harm the civilian life of the population, and Israel's methods do not have to be altered. The court was responding to a petition filed by 10 human rights groups. The Israeli government has argued the fuel limitations will create popular pressure against Palestinian militants who continue to fire rockets at Israel, arguably because of Israeli sanctions against Gaza. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
At Palestine Square in the heart of Gaza City, fuel is still being sold out of Gaza stations, while the region is suffering a sharp shortage of fuel supplies. Ahmad Aqil is a street vendor who has been selling Egyptian fuel since Israel cut the amount of fuel shipped to the Gaza Strip.
I have brought some fuel from the town of Al-Arish recently, so I can sell it here. There is no fuel here, so I am trying to earn a living.
Gaza has faced a series of economic sanctions after Hamas seized power in the region. On Wednesday, the Israeli Supreme Court ruled that a cut in fuel supplies to the coastal region will remain in effect, saying that such a decrease is intended to stop homemade rocket fire into Israel and over the long term to force a change in Hamas leadership. The Gaza Strip's population rejects the ruling, considering it a further act of collective punishment against them. On Tuesday, the United States blocked passing a non-binding United Nations Security Council's resolution that condemns Israel's actions as collective punishment against Gaza's 1.5 million residents. Prof. Assad Abu Sharikh, a political analyst in Gaza, says that the court's ruling is improper.
I think this is a very bad, silly, stupid decision against international law, against international humanitarian law. Very bad decision. I think this is going to perpetuate violence in this part of the world. And this is such a decision is not accepted by the Palestinian people or by the Arab people or by the world or by international law. And I think Israel must be punished for taking such a stupid decision against the Palestinian people.
According to Gaza's fuel station society, Israel allowed in this week limited quantities of fuel into Gaza, and most of these quantities went to the stores of United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, or UNRWA. Early this week, Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak confirmed that the fuel supplies to Gaza will be minimized until homemade rockets fired into Israel come to a halt. Last September, Israel declared the coastal territory a hostile entity and began in October a series of punitive measures against the population, including fuel supplies cut. Last week, hundreds of thousands of Gazans flooded into the nearby Egyptian town of Al-Arish to buy essential supplies amidst a crippling Israeli closure of the region since last June, when the Islamist Hamas movement took complete control over there. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
As Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf returns from his European tour, the people of Pakistan are suffering under record wheat prices and power shortages, which are making life difficult for the working class as well as business owners. The wheat crisis is the result in part of the smuggling of wheat into neighboring countries and inaccurate government projections. FSRN's Devin Terrio Orr reports.
At a local market underneath a canvas tent, day laborers gather to eat at a popular, inexpensive food stand. The owner, Kashif, has been forced to raise the price of roti, a flatbread, due to the cost of wheat, which has increased by 50% over the past month.
When we increase the price of roti, the day laborers who came to eat here yelled that I'm jacking the price of roti sky high. My customers are still coming, but those who bought 10 rotis now are buying two. The people are eating here, but a man who used to fill his stomach and go to sleep is now not eating enough.
In a country where 70% of the population lives on less than $2 a day, the wheat crisis is having a devastating impact, according to Sahib Haq of the United Nations World Food Program.
Wheat is the cheapest for the rural families. More than 50% calories in rural area is taken from wheat flour alone. But the present increase in the prices, they are reducing their consumption. So this means they are not shifting to other commodities because rice is also very, very expensive.
Kulsum, a domestic worker, confirms Hawk's statement.
Milk. We didn't buy it normally anyway, but now we've completely stopped because bread is essential. There's no milk for the kids. Previously, we used to save, buy fruit, but that has all stopped. We only get by on bread.
Pakistanis like Kulsum complain that the high price of wheat is the result of government-sanctioned exports in 2007. But the government is instead citing smuggling, hoarding, and transportation disruptions arising from Benazir Bhutto's assassination in late December as the sole causes of the increased prices. Economics professor Abid Berkey from the Lahore University of Management Sciences confirms that the price of wheat in Pakistan is substantially cheaper than in neighboring India and Afghanistan due to government subsidies to flour mills. As a result of this price differential, smuggling has occurred, according to Berkey.
Now, when international price is high, so naturally, the countries which are giving subsidy and where their prices are low than international prices, so it is quite natural to expect that there will be smuggling. So smuggling has taken place from Pakistan to Afghanistan, to India, and even to other countries.
Yet, 2 years ago, there was a surplus of wheat, and Pakistan's government projected another surplus of over 1 million metric tons for 2007, and so it exported the country's reserves. What they didn't bank on was a shortfall. Professor Berkey notes that these inaccurate government projections spell trouble in an election year.
The policy of exporting the available surpluses in May 2007 on the basis of incorrect estimates of production, I think this is a major blow to the previous policy. And I think consumers generally consider the previous government responsible for that. So I think it can have some impact on election.
Consumers such as Kulsum and her husband Mumtaz, a rickshaw driver, place the blame on the present administration.
The worst is Pervez Musharraf. The worst. who has grabbed us and created such conditions that I won't see worse even after I die.
No politician is any good,
but he's the worst.
Even if they put a donkey cart driver on the seat, he would be better than these rulers.
He'll also become like them. One look at money and they all go mad.
Both Berkey and Hawk say that consumer subsidies targeting poor people, such as those used in India providing price-controlled wheat to those below the poverty line, would work better than the present policy of blanket subsidies to industry. Amidst government claims that the issue has been resolved, Berkey and Hawk claim that the wheat crisis requires long-term structural changes. But in the immediate future, tens of millions of poor Pakistanis will continue to struggle to feed their families. For FSRN, this is Devon Terrio Orr from Lahore, Pakistan, reporting.
9,300 United Airlines mechanics are set to vote on whether they want to leave the Aircraft Mechanics Fraternal Association in favor of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. Several disgruntled mechanics have said the Teamsters would better represent their interests, but the mechanics union could face decertification if they don't get a 50% majority to favor the move. Correspondent Max Pringle reports.
The National Mediation Board authorized an election last week. A date has not been set, but the vote is expected within a month or so. There are about 10,000 United Airlines mechanics eligible to vote. Some 5,600 of them are active mechanics, and 3,700 are furloughed but can be recalled to work. Over 3,000 United mechanics work at the United Maintenance Facility at San Francisco International Airport. A group of 12 dissatisfied mechanics at the SFO facility, calling themselves the Committee for Change, is leading the effort to switch to the Teamsters. Chairman Richard Petrovsky said the Teamsters have the size and organizational skill to take on the airlines.
There's a strength of 1.4 million members in the Teamsters organization right now. They have the defined benefit pension plan. It's really important that we have that kind of security to look forward to in the future.
But Aircraft Mechanics Fraternal Association officials say their union's strong democratic tradition means a lot more than simple size of membership roles. Joseph Prisco is president of AMFA Local 9 in San Francisco.
It doesn't matter how large the union is. If you don't have a democratic voice inside that union, and if you don't have access to those large funds that they keep throwing around to the membership, what does it matter? The Teamsters have a decades-long history of internal corruption. They're still under government supervision, and they believe in secret negotiations. We allow our members to observe the negotiations in progress.
Teamsters officials say they can offer the mechanics the strength of long-established relationships with elected officials who can be valuable allies to the mechanics. Teamsters spokeswoman Leslie Miller says friends in Congress can help put the brakes on outsourcing of jobs and other favors.
We have friends on Capitol Hill. We have the ability to make political donations to friends on Capitol Hill who can help the mechanics in their efforts to stop the outsourcing and to find out what happened to their pensions.
AMFA says the upcoming vote risks the decertification of both unions at the San Francisco facility. Joseph Prisco says both unions could potentially lose.
If we don't get at least 50% plus one of the eligible voters to participate in the vote, then we could be decertified. Meaning, if you don't get enough people to participate in total, it doesn't matter who wins the election.
The Committee for Change said AMFA did little to fight the outsourcing of some United Mechanics jobs overseas. It also said the union is unresponsive to its members. AMFA denies that charge. The union said the better tactic for all unions representing airline mechanics would be to caucus as a group to come up with a plan to fight outsourcing and other issues facing their members. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle in San Francisco.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.